I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
Let's try and make this sound really natural because we can pretend that we haven't just been recording for 20 minutes and only to discover that the audio wasn't working. And right. So we're starting again.
Yeah.
So this is going to sound really incredible. How are you doing, my friend?
It's been a while since we've talked.
It's been,
I haven't seen you in so long.
So many minutes. oh, boy. Everyone gets a very much a warts and all view of our our podcast. You know, you and I have always said this is low effort for us because otherwise we'd stop doing it. It's just we don't want to like spend too much time on it, but we care enough to do it like somewhat properly.
I think we got a good system.
I think so.
That's the key.
It's working pretty well. Anyway, so a few minutes ago we were just talking and I was saying to you how much when I ask you how you're doing, it's more of a genuine question because these days I don't hang out with you half as much.
Yeah,
because
I legitimately have not seen you in a while other than 10 minutes ago when we recorded this the first time.
When we recorded the introduction that didn't work. But the TLDR or the TR didn't where the R of TLDR is record, too long didn't record. I have moved on from the company that we both worked together at, and I am currently on a short break between jobs, enjoying the good life and working on Compiler Explorer. And it's of no fault of my previous employer. I still think they're fantastic, and I know that you're happy there, and there's a lot of cool things going on there, but it was an opportunity for me to do something new and different, and I took it, and here we are. But we're still hanging out, and we're still recording a podcast and we still have important and interesting things to discuss. And if anything, this means that we're less likely to accidentally leak company. I don't anymore.
Right. Yeah, actually. Yeah. A few people actually who knew that you had moved to a new firm had asked me, like, are you guys going to keep doing the podcast? And I was like, absolutely. Like, this is my chance to talk to Matt every week. Cause now I don't have the built-in one of, you know, riding the train home or whatever it might be.
Or getting coffee or something. Which we obviously can do still. Yeah. But I've moved on. I'm excited to do something new and different. And if you care about such things, you can follow me on Blue Sky or Hackaderm or one of those things, and you can see what I'm up to there. But I'm not going to go into it here because this is not what this podcast is about. This podcast is about you and me chatting about code and our experiences coding and the things we like about coding. And today, again, it's so difficult to get excited about something we've just talked about and try and pretend it's new and fresh.
Yeah.
And or today, I was teaching a computer to program for me, or asking a computer to program for me, because I'm too lazy to program. I'm too old now.
Right.
I've forgotten everything. Yeah. I just ask it to do it. It does it now. So, so today's topic is AI. What do we think about AI and programming, and do we use it and whatnot? So, I'll start. Yeah, go on.
GPT, please explore the compiles.
That's right. That's pretty much, actually, you'd be surprised how much. I haven't actually used it on Compiler Explorer very much. Occasionally I do. So a few minutes ago, we were discussing that pairing with an AI is like sort of pairing with either a junior programmer was one sort of...
That was an observation that an ex-colleague of mine made once, which I thought was good.
You then said something which was more amusing. And
I think it's more like that's like not completely wrong, but I think a maybe better way to think about it is a very senior programmer who is currently taking LSD.
Right.
Because you get a lot of like very interesting and cool things mixed with like, that doesn't work, that has never worked. And actually, now that I think about it, it could not possibly work.
Yes.
That happens too.
Yeah, that does. The junior thing I think rings home for me a little bit more. I mean, I have obviously seen it make up APIs that don't exist before now. But usually a gentle nudge in the conversation window to say like, hey, I tried that and it didn't work. It's very apologetic. And then goes, oh, sorry about that. Yeah, that's not the right thing at all. And you're like, okay, yeah. Well, why did you tell me then? But it seems like, a junior programmer who is incredibly voraciously learned everything that there can possibly be about all possible topics. So it's like one of those very keen people that has had no experience implementing anything. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the knowledge is amazing, but putting it into practice is difficult, the executive part of that. And that's how I found it. But yeah, we were saying that, like, you know, if you've got like a knowledge deficit like I have, so the things that I've used it for on Compiler Explorer is, so I've got Copilot integrated into one of my IDs, and I'll say, oh, I don't know how to phrase this in TypeScript because, frankly, I don't know TypeScript very well. Mm-hmm. And it's very good at saying, oh, yeah, this is how you explain this type to the system. And then you try it and it doesn't work. And you say, well, that didn't work because of this. And it goes, oh, yeah, silly me. And that's been very, and it eventually gets there. That has been very useful for me. What have your experiences been with using AI? How do you use it, if you use it?
Yeah, I mean, I have not done as much of, like, I think there's three basic styles that I'm aware of let's call it AI-assisted coding. Okay. The most basic form is chat. So you just open a separate chat window from whatever tool that, you know, IDE or editor you're using, and you just ask it questions and it gives you answers, right? And there's a lot of, you know, maybe copying and pasting code, depending on exactly how you
do that. I'm just going to pause you there, because one thing I'd think I only became recently aware of is how much extra context, if you're opening up in, say, your IDE, how much extra context your IDE's like plugin or whatever is sharing with the AI.
Yeah.
So like, I have been very surprised that it can look at my clipboard and kind of realize that I've selected, you know, even my X clipboard, i.e. the stuff I have selected in another application. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, yeah, you probably want to paste that stuff in. I'm like, oh, that's creepy. So that's, I didn't realize that, but it's obviously valuable to the system. You know, here are the last three files I've been looking at. Here's the thing my mouse pointer is hovering over. A little bit of extra context. And then it gives it a little bit more mind reading ability than I perhaps was expecting when I'm just sort of chatting with it.
Right,
if you open up a chat GPT window somewhere else in a web browser and then start asking it code questions.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the model there you're describing is sort of the second one that I would say, which is, you know, you have the tool integrated into your IDE and you're chatting with it and you're saying, like, can you please do this or can you change that? And then the third model that I've seen is like sort of AI enhanced code completion, where it is like, as you're typing, it's like filling out, you know, graying out code that it kind of wants to type. And say, like, here's the thing that you could do here, right? And I think those are three rather distinct modes, right?
That's true. I would add to that, there's a fourth one that I've seen recently, which I suppose is like 2+, right? With the two, that is an IDE-based editor. Mm-hmm. You're generally driving the show and, you know, it says, hey, you know, things that I would do is highlight a function and say, can you simplify this, please? Or can you make it more, you know, TypeScripty? And then it will give me, hey, what about this? And then I go, yes. And I can click a button and then replace the code I've highlighted with whatever the AI has come up with. Mm-hmm. But then there are more, like, this is a new word I learned the other day, agentic, but that is to say agent-like, where the AI has agency of its own plugins. And I was observing somebody, a friend of mine, like driving the IDE by using a plugin that actually can itself drive the IDE. So he'd ask it to say, can you add new files? Can you refactor this? And it would do all of the things in one go. And it would run the test and they would fail and it would feed back the failure of the test and it would actually iterate itself until it had got to a stage where it said, hey, I did the things you asked me. Are you happy? And then you click yes, or you go, no, roll it back and we'll try again. And that was, you know, that seems to be very much more like to the second case, but with its own agency. But I wonder if it's distinct at all. You know, the second
I think I would call that like a fourth mode, where it's like you're not really the programmer anymore, right?
You are the executive programmer.
Well, bringing this back to a pairing analogy, right?
Right.
Like you always had the driver and the navigator, right? Uh-huh. And in sort of traditional, you know, XP style pairing, the whole idea of that was that the driver doesn't make any technology decisions. The purpose of the navigator was to say, like, to communicate their ideas to the driver, and the driver would type what they think they heard. And that was supposed to be a feedback loop to make sure that you really had expressed an idea that was like cohesive.
Got it. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, like, to me, that model sounds like I'm pair programming, but I'm the navigator, right? And the AI is the driver.
That does seem more like it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, in this particular instance, this is a friend, actually a mutual friend of ours who I'm currently sharing an office with. We rented a temporary mm-hmm. office space so that I don't drive my poor, long-suffering wife insane by me being around all the time at the moment. He's a lapsed programmer. He used to be a programmer, but isn't anymore. He's more of a manager type person. And he has been working on some code by driving the IDE. And it's amazing to see how much he's been able to do without literally writing a line of code. Now, he can code, but he hasn't done it for a while. And it's, he's got this sort of web application with a game and these pieces moving around. And he's like, yeah, I should like for the middle mouse wheel to zoom in and out of the map. Mm-hmm. And then the middle mouse button to pan. And it goes, I gotcha. And it just makes all these changes. He looks at it and he goes, yeah, it seems to work, and commits it and then just moves. And I'm like, wow. I mean, it is fairly unambiguous when you say that, but it's like it's the AI has understood the flow of his current program well enough to be able to then say, I can see how you would add panning and zooming into this application, which is one of those things that is a pain in the bum to get right if you try and mm-hmm. do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's that's cool.
Yeah. There's 2D matrix transformations in there and a bunch of other things that you really don't want to have to think about too hard.
That's right. I mean, sure. You'd get there in the end, but
yeah.
It was fascinating to see, and watching it work is like creepy. It's like, you know, the IDE is driving itself. All these things are popping up and down. Things are moving around. Files are being edited, and then, you know, it's explaining what it's doing in its little window. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's cool, but you know, there is obviously potential for a darker side, and without going into like some of the, you know, obviously there are IP concerns, but there's also the are computers taking away our jobs side to this too? And so far, I'm like, not in a meaningful way, because that was toil that my friend needed to do and could possibly have done or worked it out himself, but he could just ask it to do. But he's still making executive decisions about like, yeah, I don't like the way it did this, or this class is more complicated, and iterating with it. So there's still some programming knowledge that's required and needed. But I can see the beginnings of something that maybe, say, there is a category of programming work that is made accessible to more people in a way that doesn't require a specialist knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most positive way I can spin it. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, what do you think about this? We both have kids that are looking at a college age. Would you recommend going into computers?
Yeah. Well, full disclosure, my oldest is going into a computer science program at a prestigious school nearby. And they have asked me this question. I have told them I've told them a bunch of things, which I'm probably about to recount on this podcast. But I've told them that, like, if I were to summarize this in one sort of paragraph, it's like, what kind of effect do you think that AI will have on human society over the next, let's say, 50 years? Do you think it will make computers more important to us or less important to us? And I think the answer is pretty obvious when you phrase it like that.
Yeah.
I think what's happening right now, and what may happen for a little bit, is there is a little bit of what I would maybe call an economic dislocation, in that there is probably not an infinite amount of demand for software engineers, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is certainly an amount of demand that up until now has gone unfulfilled because the cost is just too high, right? Like, this gets back to a little bit of like, you know, an economics 101 class about minimum wage, right? Like, you raise minimum wage, you raise the standard of living, but you also create inflation and you also drive businesses out of business. So, like, you know, a practical example for us living in Chicago is that Chicago raised its minimum wage to $15 an hour. I don't know if that has fully taken effect yet. I think they've been rolling it out in stages. It might have actually fully taken effect. Mm-hmm. And there are, when you go down to Ogilvy Station, which is the train station that, you know, we would ride into every day, you see a lot of storefronts, and those storefronts are empty, and they have been empty since COVID, right? And I wonder to myself, when I walk past those storefronts, if Chicago had not raised the minimum wage, how many of these stores would now be open? And I would be very surprised if the answer is it would be exactly the same, right? There has to be one or two stores that were kind of right on the cusp of being profitable.
It was the sort of final straw is that they,
Yeah. And then it's like, you know what? With a $15 minimum wage, this store just doesn't make sense to have open, right? There has to be at least one, right?
Obviously, I think you and I agree on most political sides of things. You know, I don't necessarily think that's a wrong thing. I think that meant
economics, right?
That store was not economically viable and shouldn't have been, you know, more. But yeah, from a pure dispassionate economic point of view,
right?
I agree. I think that makes sense. And
yeah.
So are you sort of making the argument that what we're doing now is we've reduced the minimum wage, inverted commas, of programmers, because now if I'm an estate agent, sorry, realtor, I translate for you, and I need to change my website, I don't have to call up the website company anymore because I can load up my website and tell an AI, can you just change some things about this for me, please? Or can you make it so this happens?
That's not exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying like the real estate agent would never have even had a website. And now they can, because it wouldn't have made economic sense for them to have a web development company because it was too expensive, right? Yep. So they just wouldn't. And now,
but I mean, like, so I took that, for example, just purely because one of my friends at home is this, and like, he paid like £200 once to get his website once, and he's got like a zip file, and that's his website, and it's been his website for like 20 years now. And now it's like, well, I've never changed it from that, and because I can't afford to keep paying someone to change it.
Right.
But now maybe I can get the computer to make changes for me, and I can say, can you update this house or whatever? And I don't need to really know what's going on. So, and in that way, this is what we're saying is AI is a tool, and tools are in the right hands useful. And maybe, you know, like a wrench, a spanner. Again, I'm doing, I don't know why I'm switching, code switching between English and American here.
Yeah.
Freedom speech. oh boy. So much wrong with that at the moment. Anyway, there's a number of things that you can't. I was just literally replacing this battery of my sump pump downstairs, and I'm like, I can't get the wing nuts off of the terminals. Mm-hmm. But am I going to call someone in? No, I've got a tool to do this for me. I can use a wrench, and now suddenly I've got enough leverage for it, and that's fine. And so you're getting leverage to people, and maybe AI is programmer leverage. That's certainly how I personally use it, but maybe it's leverage for non-programmers. I was about to say muggles then, but that's probably not.
Normies?
No, how about that one? I don't know that either.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, it is, and it's like putting, as I was getting to before, I don't think there's an infinite amount of demand for programmers. There is a lot of demand for programmers, and it is also possible that having AI will actually increase the total net demand for programming, because as my previous statement kind of alluded to, computers are going to get more important to humanity over the next 50 years, not less important, right? And so the question is, at what rate will that increase? And it might increase very quickly because of this, right? But certainly in the short term, what this is doing is reducing the unfulfilled demand for programmers by dramatically increasing the sort of total supply of program-ish, right? Like, you can either be an expert programmer who is even now more productive, and I certainly think you and I can speak to that, of like the way that we've used these tools to get things done way faster than we would have before. And
absolutely,
and we should talk about some specific examples of that. But also everyone else who is attempting to write code, whether they be a realtor who's just trying to update their website, or somebody who used to be in programming and hasn't done it for 20 years, or somebody who is just learning, or somebody who is just treating it like their day job and just like, I just need to get more stuff done. All of those people are now going to be more productive because of these tools, right? And so that has the effect of sort of filling in gaps in the demand that were there before. And, you know, unfortunately for us, perhaps reducing the total amount of compensation that we can expect to get because our skills are so limited and therefore in so much demand. I would argue that from a purely economic perspective, that is nothing but good. From a sort of selfish perspective, it's like maybe not the best, but I'm willing to take the trade because it makes me as an individual more productive.
Right.
And for somebody who kind of getting back to, you know, this hypothetical person who might be going into a computer science degree and considering this as a vocation, I would say if you're in it because you want to make a lot of money, you can probably do better. But if you're in it because you love programming, that's not going away.
Right. And certainly I think that advice fell on to our eldest, and they were very, that is why they're into it, right? They love it. So that makes sense in that sense. Yeah, that's definitely, I think that's good advice anyway, if you can do something you love, because I mean, certainly at university, something you love because you can stick to it and maybe it demonstrates the ability to learn. But that's a whole other conversation about why we're way in the weeds with that now. But it's interesting that you might say there are more. I suppose, again, that we're coming at this because, you know, we are considerably closer to retirement than we are from starting our careers.
Right.
Which is sad to say out loud.
Yeah.
And so
maybe a third of the way.
Oh, you are younger than me, in fairness. Yeah.
Well, no, I'm just going to program till I drop.
Well, I think that's another thing, right? You know, you and I, as everyone who's listening to this podcast knows, we love this. We would do this anyway. I am doing this anyway. I am between jobs, and I'm doing it because I love it, not because I'm, you know, being specifically paid to do it.
Yeah.
And so it's very, and like literally while we're talking, Discord notifications popped up where friends of mine are working on like Amiga demos and still, you know, for a computer that has been obsolete for 30 years, you know, that's because people love this. It's, we're very lucky that at the moment we still get paid reasonably well to do what we enjoy.
Yeah.
The economics of that may shift as AI changes things, but you know, who makes the AI? Well, I suppose there becomes a point, there's maybe an inflection point where at the point at which AI becomes determining of its own future, designs itself, updates itself under maybe some human direction. But at that point, I guess that's the singularity type feel or whatever. And maybe that's a different thing. But like, I can see a world in which it takes off and then we're all in trouble, or we can all retire and live in the world of Star Trek, which would be nice.
I don't have too much hope for the.
There's a certain amount of political background that indicates that's the opposite of that might be happening. But that's,
I mean the sort of need free society. I'm not holding my breath on that one.
No, sure.
But I do think it is like the recent developments with DeepSeek, I think, are a very interesting and important step in this whole conversation. I think we would be remiss to not talk about that.
Absolutely.
Because it really seems like, because one of my biggest concerns with sort of the long term of this has been essentially like AI vendor lock-in, right? Like if these are going to be tools that we rely on to do things, I don't want to be beholden. I mean, this is like the bad old days of Microsoft and like the, you know, 90s where it's like, you need to pay the Windows tax whenever you buy a new computer. And like, you know, everything was just sort of locked up by them. And that's just like terrible for so many reasons. And I think that a lot of what, at least in my career, I sort of gravitated to was open source, not only because you had access to the source code, but also because of the sort of freeze and speech aspects of it that allowed you to do what you needed to do and never get boxed into a situation. And like, you know, the scenario I was painting to a friend of mine the other day about this was, so imagine that you are one of these people who's not really a programmer, but you sort of figure out how to do things using AI, right? Mm-hmm. And you build a little tool or something that is useful to you, and then you change it a little bit and it works really well. And you're like, you know, maybe I could sell this, right? And so you continue to use AI to build like a website or something, or, you know, you get on some payment portal and you set something up and you start selling this thing and it does pretty well, right? And you, it's sort of like your side gig and you do this for a while and then it starts to become like your main source of income. And you're like, you know what, I could just quit my day job and I could just do this, right? And you keep making some improvements to it and you sort of do this sort of pair programming style thing with the AI where it's like you say, and make changes to do this and changes to do that and changes to this, right? And then you, you know, have done this for a couple of years now and you fully quit your job and you've, you, this is how you pay your rent. And then one day you go to make some change to your thing because, you know, there's like some update somewhere or something's broken or there's new thing. Oh, I got to go fix this. And you ask the AI to do it and it doesn't.
And you have,
and then you ask again, and it doesn't.
Nothing.
And you ask again, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
And you're like, "What's going on here? I don't know what to do."
Yeah.
And then your thing stops working, and then people stop paying for it, and then you don't pay your rent.
Right. I mean, to an extent, I mean, what you're talking about, obviously, vendor lock-in is true in many other parts of the world too. I mean, you think about. Right.
But this isn't it isn't just the vendor lock-in.
No, there is something more insidious.
Understanding, right? Like you built a thing that you don't understand.
Yeah.
And you have no way, no recourse at all to fix it.
Yeah. That's a really interesting, because what I was going to, so the thing that was coming to mind was, you know, folks who make a living from being YouTube people on Patreon mm-hmm. or whatever. It's like, yeah, but you know, YouTube could say, no, you can't do this anymore, or it could stop working or whatever, or Patreon could say like, yeah, we're shutting down or whatever. And you got like, but they still understand what they've got. Maybe they don't own their uploads, but maybe they do still have it somewhere. You know, you could imagine them setting up shop. They are not, it's not built. The foundations are still there, right? If you are a social media influencer and you do interesting stuff, then that stuff is still interesting to somebody somewhere, presumably, and some new site will come up and you can be like, okay, I've got my things, I'll move over to this new site. Whereas with this, there are no foundations. The foundation is a black box. I suppose it's not totally, because you could say, all right, if it's worth it, you could hire some software engineers.
Hopefully
and say,
somebody knows still how to program by then, right? Like that's the thing, is that there, I think this is why there will always be a demand.
No,
for
you're
people
right.
who understand computers and programming.
A thing that already is a little bit insidious. Now, I think I have more of a problem with this than most people would do, but it's the reproducibility aspect of it.
Right.
You know, today, you know, already there's randomness inside the way that they work, and I kind of get that. But like, you could imagine them not making it. I mean, you didn't even suggest that it was going away. Actually, you just said it didn't, right? So this is perhaps the same thing. I'm just having the same realization. You go to say, can you make a thing change in this way? And it does it in a way that doesn't make any sense anymore. And you can't change it, or you can't, you know, it doesn't have to just go away. Yeah, this is your point. It's like, it can just change. You've got no recourse. Whereas in the open source model, you're like, I still have the code on my computer. I don't necessarily understand it, but I have it here. I have a copy of it. Whereas, and I suppose to an extent, you know, things like AWS is another vendor, which I'm very much locked into.
Oh, yeah.
And, tomorrow they could tell me that they're deprecating something that I absolutely rely on, and I'm stuffed. So this already exists in different ways, but I'm stuffed in the same way. Yeah, I'm going around in circles in my head here, but I do think there is a material difference between I know what I'm doing and I'm relying on things that do that for me. In AWS, you know, it's a load balancer and whatever, and a storage system or whatever. And it would be a pain in the bum to change it, but I can, versus I've built an empire on something I don't understand.
Right, right. Or I've built a critical tool on top of something I don't understand.
And I wonder how much that's common in business, full stop, right? You know, like how many CEOs? Yeah.
Sure. And it's like, I'm not saying this is fatal. I'm not saying like, and this is why AI won't work. It's like, it's just introducing a risk. And I think it is a pretty significant risk that you don't have when you have people who actually understand the code that is being written and
Although
how it works.
They can, for example, leave the company. That seems like a thing that might be top of mind for some of us.
Right.
And so there's an interesting aspect to it there as well. But it seems more in your control. You can, as an employer, as somebody who's managing, you take into account, we've talked about crypto risk, I think, as we've called it, which is bust risk to everybody else on this podcast before. You manage it, and whereas you can't manage it when it's a magical, mystical genie in a bottle that someone else will rent to you.
Yes, exactly. exactly
on a day by day basis.
And, right.
Yeah.
And I think DeepSeek, again, bringing it back to that, makes that easier in that, like, you can go and you can get a model and just be like, all right, I'm just not going to change this. Right. This does what I need it to do. And there is kind of like two layers of this, by the way. There's the system that you build that is built by an AI, but fundamentally what it produces is just code that you run. Yep. And then there is a system that relies on an AI for its operation, right? Yes. And that has a much greater risk of just one day not working and you don't understand why, right? So there are two different modes there, but I think it's kind of the same thing of like you're exposing yourself to this vendor lock-in, this thing that, like, you know, back in the 90s, we were very acutely aware of that existed. And it's like a slightly different dimension on it, of course, and there's different things there. But it's a risk that, like, there's a reason that open source got so popular, right? And one of the reasons is it mitigated this risk significantly.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously, I've never really thought of it that way.
Like, also have that effect.
Yeah. The thing about DeepSeek is it, and maybe this is, again, slightly different than open source. So, you know, I could use Microsoft SQL Server, and I have all the problems of lock-in that we've just talked about.
Right.
I could use SQLite or some other, MySQL or whatever it's called these days, and I can have the source code. It won't change from underneath me and everything, but I still don't really understand it unless I'm super into databases as a user of databases. Mm-hmm. I couldn't, you know, if, for example, they suddenly changed the licensing rules, or I can't imagine what sequence of events could make an open source thing go away, but if they stop maintaining it, and I can't maintain it, or I can't afford to maintain it, or don't understand it, I have a similar problem. And in this, the DeepSeek has another issue, which is like they can give you an open source model, but can you train it yourself? And so far, they're like, no, that's magical stuff that happens behind the scenes and requires more money than you have access to, even though it's considerably less than perhaps some of the other models. And that seems to be interesting to me, that it's a slightly subtly different open than other opens, and unless I'm missing something, am I misunderstanding how?
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Like, if you want to train your own model, it's going to be like millions of dollars, right? Isn't that how that works? So it's like, that's a pretty significant barrier. But like the I think the analogy in that particular case, like, let's say that you built a system. It's not that you built a system with DeepSeek, right? Like, you built a system that you wrote the code and it uses DeepSeek to do something. And it uses DeepSeek, right?
So it's,
that's not all that different from, like, hey, I've got this database that I don't understand, or I've got
it's
this
very AWS similar, yes.
I don't understand. Because you understand how to change that code. And if that component, whatever it may be, stops working, you have a reasonable expectation. It's like, all right, this is going to be a pain in the butt, but, like, I can fix this and I can redo this and I can do that. And, like, you know, you can find ways to at least patch around it, if not just get it working again. Whereas if your entire ability to change the software at all is reliant on a tool that you fundamentally don't understand how it works, and you don't even really understand what it produces, then you can easily get into a state where you just can't make changes at all. And, like, the one thing that I have seen in my career is software that can't change dies. It has to be able to change, because the world changes around you. And if you don't change with it, the software stops being used. Right.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like the greater risk for me, is like a world where we have not only the things that we do in our day jobs, but we maybe have like critical pieces of infrastructure, you know, the sort of myth. What happens when the load bearing internet person is just, you know, DeepSeek.
Yeah.
Right. And, like, there's this critical piece of infrastructure that everyone else depends on, and nobody understands how it works anymore, because it turns out the maintainer died and his AI took over, right?
it's very – that is – I see the difference in kind between those things, you know, and the open source model is different to – that I built something with a tool that I don't understand, that I can't understand what it built either. That's really – Without getting a bit of a change then, we talked about some of the ways, and it's a bit of a gramophone needle scratch kind of moment here, but I feel like, you know, as we're coming up on time, and I'm thinking it's at least worth talking a little bit about some of the productivity boost that, you know, we alluded to earlier. I don't want to be like all sort of semi doom and gloom about this kind of stuff, because I think, you know, there are a lot of positive things. We started out reasonably positive. Mm-hmm. And so some of the success stories I think I've already said for me were like, you know, getting it to do, I don't understand TypeScript, can you please do this thing? Or, you know, can you refactor this code? Or can you make suggestions even? Like, and those are very like pair programming thing. And sometimes it's really, really good at that. Mm-hmm. I've had, so the thing that I've been doing recently, which would be a surprise to nobody who's listened to this for any length of time, is I'm actually working on yet another emulator. And I'm working on a Z80 emulator for a conference talk. And I'm experimenting with different ways of writing a CPU emulator to see how they come out. And I'm also experimenting with different types of C++ functionality. But anyway, the Z80 obviously is an incredibly well-known, well-understood CPU. And there's obviously a lot of information about it on the internet. But I've been remarkably impressed with how my particular take of it currently, at least the current incarnation, is more like a traditional decode. So I'm switching on the opcode. And then I'm returning a structure that describes what that opcode does. And one of the things in that structure is like the actual string that is the opcode. And then there's a bunch of other flags, like how many more bytes am I expecting after this byte? What is the source? What is the destination? And, you know, those are all in nums. So, you know, each thing is like case hex 22 return quote LDHL comma BC quote comma one size of opcode comma register colon colon HL comma register colon colon BC comma and then some other nonsense that's just that. And right, okay, so it's fairly straightforward for some definition of straightforward, but I was absolutely shocked that I would write the next case statement and the AI would correctly fill in the completion for that. Mm-hmm. That is, I'm just literally in a big switch statement, the top of it is it's like huge switch opcode, and I do case hex 33 colon. And it says return, and it's filled it in. So it's like worked mm-hmm, out mm-hmm. that this is a Z80, and then therefore hex 33 is this opcode, and it can actually determine what my program means or needs from the opcode that was just blew me away. That was like, again, and now I want to do is just autocomplete the whole lot of them because there are hundreds of those stupid things. But obviously, testing it and checking it is the thing. That is amazing to me. And a similar story is in my 6502 emulator, I had a test which had a static const array of bytes that was a routine in just assembly, not assembly code, in machine code, right? And I just asked it, I asked the chat thing, can you comment this for me? And it worked out that it was in fact encoded 6502 and it broke it onto multiple lines. And for each like hex 33, and it had the comment of like, this is load A with 27. I'm like, mm-hmm. Again, bonkers level sort of beginnings of reasoning about what I'm doing, not just like predicting. I don't know. It felt good. It felt really clever. Mm-hmm. So that's amazing when that happens.
Yeah. But,
so what have you got any cool stories?
I mean, I think you kind of hit on it there, which is, you know, my perspective on these things is the older something is, the better AI is going to be at dealing with it, right? So like really well-worn public APIs and tools it so good at, right?
Funny little Python tools that interact with the YouTube APIs. And I asked it through it. It just wrote the whole thing from scratch and I never had to understand it.
All of those APIs that have been around for a reasonable period of time and are very well-worn, it is so good at that. And it has gotten to the point where it's like, you know, rarely will I do things like look up the documentation first. Usually I'm looking up the documentation only to double check what it is that the, you know, LLM in question has done.
Yeah.
Or to just make sure that I understand it. Right.
Yeah.
But like anything that is older like that is it's so good at, and it's funny because I've thought a few times, I'm going to dip slightly back into the doom and gloom for just one second because it's not really doom and gloom. I think this is actually kind of a good thing. But one of my concerns with these tools has been like, are we just going to turn into like human QA, right? Are we going to like, okay, the AI is going to, you know, dump out all the terrible code and then our jobs are going to be to fix it, right? And I actually think a probably more realistic version of that is it's going to be our jobs to learn the new stuff and leave the old stuff to the computers, because the computers will have the sort of encyclopedic knowledge of like all of the APIs that have been out there for years and years and years and the best way to use them. And what our job is going to be is the like, you know, hey, I built my tool in this LLM and I based my whole business around it, and it stopped working, and I don't understand why. It's like, oh yeah, because they released a new version of the API that you use, and the LLM hasn't picked it up yet. And so my job as a programmer is to be like, hey, somebody built a new thing. I need to learn how to use the new thing because the AIs haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah.
And I think there's going to be a lot of that where it's like, yeah, like in some ways it makes me a little sad because sort of like the old graybeard thing of like, yeah, I know every corner of this API and I know exactly how it works and I know where all the bodies are buried. Like maybe it's not as useful as it used to be anymore. But what it does mean is that maybe what that means is we're going to be working on new stuff. And, you know, I like working on new stuff. It's fun. It's interesting. It's cool. But yeah, I bring it back to the original topic here is of like, yeah, all of those sort of like public well-worn APIs, tools that have been around for a while. It is so good at knowing those things. It writes a lot of the same code that I would write. Obviously, like I have very particular things around testability that I do, and I have tried
to talk about that sometime.
Yeah. Maybe once or twice. And I have tried to like, you know, you can do the things, especially with like some of these tools where you tell it to remember things. And I've tried to like teach it like, oh, this is the kind of stuff that I like. This is the kind of stuff that I don't like. This works for this and this works for this. And I think it's maybe getting better at it. I'm not really sure. So I wind up refactoring that code a lot, or not even refactoring it because the code that it spits out isn't really tested or testable, but I like wind up, you know, turning it into something that I can then write tests around and then sort of doing the reverse driving of those tests where I like break the code and make sure that the test fail.
Right. That is actually one of the nice, I mean, so a landmark moment in me, my understanding of AI was realizing that I could be much more discursive about saying what I liked and what I didn't like as kind of part of a founding document, which, was a huge like, oh gosh, yeah, that makes sense. You know, tell it, don't do this. I don't like it.
Yeah, right.
That's a useful thing, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just trying to write generic code from the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing would be, like writing tests is very good. So this was back when I was working with you, although at the same company. I had a very warty, complicated piece of code that was very thready. I think we probably talked about these things. And I asked the AI to try and poke holes in it, and it did. And I had to argue with it to prove to it that like there wasn't a window of opportunity when it a thread bug would happen. Mm-hmm. And that was valuable too, because it was like having a very smart person to argue with, and I didn't have to expose myself as being not sure about it to anybody else, although I am just talking about it in public. Also auto completing, and I would say I point at my tests and say, what are missing? Can you tell me what kinds of things are missing? He goes, oh, have you thought about these? These are edge cases here. And then very often it would auto complete in the test. You know, you could just write the test, the description, you know, should return zero for negative values, and it's like boom, there you go, you just hit tab and the whole thing auto completes. That's a valuable thing, I think, or it's at least a useful thing, you know. It takes some of the toil out of what we're doing without necessarily taking away some of the expressibility and the sort of freedom to do something cool.
It's making us all more productive, and which is net a good thing and may create some sort of weird ripples in the short term, but I think in general it's good. The whole thing kind of reminds me, I don't know if you were of this era. I think you probably were. Did you ever have a boss that was like skeptical of Googling things? Did you ever have that?
No.
First job out of school, I had a boss who was a lot older than me, and he was like, you know, you gotta read the documentation. You gotta get the docs on your computer and you gotta read through them. And you got to figure out what the software can do from that. I'm like, or I could just Google it. And he's like, no, you got to read the docs. And this sort of seems like the same sort of thing to me, where it's sort of like, you know, like I could see someone making the argument. It's like, oh yeah, you know, if you just have the AI write all the code for you, you don't understand it. It's like, well, I mean, that's not strictly true. You can understand code that other things have written. That's a thing programmers can do.
Mm-hmm. Some might say it's the most important thing programmers can do, actually.
Right. So like, you know, if the way you choose to work is to have a tool generate some code, and then you read that code and you understand what it does, and you fix it if it has any problems, and you write tests for it if the tests are incomplete or whatever, like that's a perfectly valid way to work. It's not, you know, Google the thing, look at Stack Overflow, copy and paste into your code and then repeat.
Because that's what the AI is really doing behind the scenes anyway. We haven't talked about the ethics of where it got all of its information from, right. But like, you know, way outside the scope of study time. But yeah, that's effectively, it's just you've automated that part of it.
Right. Right. Or going back to this old boss that I have, it's not like looking up the example in the documentation or the sample code that came with the library and then pasting that into your code and then editing it as appropriate.
Right.
But it is not totally dissimilar from that process, right?
That's very interesting take. Yeah. No, I've never had a boss that was skeptical of Google, thankfully. I think most of the stuff...
He came around eventually, but it was the first like 6 months I was there. He was like, oh, you got to read the docs. You got to read the docs.
I understand it. Maybe that's just because we're getting old. Yeah. And I sort of like sympathize with that kind of slightly. Yeah. That point of view. Well, we've been talking for a good old while on this, a lot more than I was expecting, and it went in a completely different direction the second time from where we started the first time. So maybe we should put a pin in it for now, and we should maybe come back with if anyone has thoughts on this episode, because I imagine this is one that people might have strong opinions one way or the other. You know, I certainly in conversation with friends, they've been like, oh my god, you use AI, ugh, kind of fear, which I was like surprised that people could have such a visceral reaction to something which I perceive as just a tool. But I also understand that maybe there's a concept of like it's stolen all the Stack Overflow things for me. Right. I don't know, and other things, but so I'd be interested if anybody has opinions on this, and maybe we could cover them if there are on a future episode. But I think we're gonna have to leave it there for today. So
yeah.
Lovely to catch up with you, my friend.
Uh-huh. I'll see you next week.
Yeah, I'll see you. Yeah. I guess so. Sometime to say. Oh, actually, no. In Inside Baseball for those now, we're recording this in February, and next week will be Valentine's Day. So maybe we won't want to be recording on the Valentine's Day.
Probably. I don't know. Things will have gone very poorly if that happens.
Well, yeah. We'll see. So it might be 2 weeks or something, or we'll do it in a week, but we'll get this episode out probably in. Oh, I'm going to say, this is cursing. I'm going to say probably in March. We never reveal when the times of these things are recorded are. But never mind. This time, special dispensation. Anyway, it's been fun. Till next time.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at www.twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Mastodon. We are at twoscompliment@hackyderm.io. Our theme music is by Inverse Phase. Find out more at inversephase.com.